Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? At least according to the True Age test from True Diagnostic. Biological age shows how fast you're aging internally, and it's a key predictor of serious disease risk. Research says if your biological age is just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk for diseases like cancer or heart disease can spike by 30 to 50%. The good news? You have influence over your true age through lifestyle, habits, and environment. I was surprised to learn my blood has fewer toxins than most, but I'm deficient in vitamin C and B2, and I need to eat more valine-rich foods like nuts, dairy, and meat. The True Age test was a breeze. Just a quick finger prick at home, no doctor visit needed. You mail it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you get a detailed report on your aging. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head out to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. Hope everyone's doing well out there. It's been a little while. Well, I guess I was on the American Churchman last night, but before that, it's been a little while. I took a little trip I guess it was 2 full days with travel, 4 days, right? You know, get there and get back to the White Mountains in New Hampshire. We were actually staying in Maine, in Lovell, Maine, which is, it's actually a quite nice little town. There aren't hotels or really any corporate anything there. And that's one of the things I liked about it. It had that small town feel, that quaint New England feel. And my wife found this Airbnb cabin. And so we just stayed there for, I guess it would have been 3 nights, and had a wonderful time just driving around, checking out little towns around there, going hiking. We went up, what do they call that? Mount Washington. I've been up there, actually hiked it a few years ago. Now it's like 10 years ago. I don't like to think about how long things are now, but it was a while ago now that I think about it. Okay, so it wasn't a few years, but I did hike it. This is the first time I actually drove up, and that's a bucket list thing, right? A lot of people, especially if you're on the East Coast, going up Mount Washington is a big deal. You get a little bumper sticker that says my car went up Mount Washington, which I'm not going to put on my car. But I've driven in Alaska, I've driven in Colorado, I've driven in California. I don't know. It's not the biggest feat I've ever I've ever been through, I suppose. So, but it's still, you know, for the Northeast, that's kind of a big deal. Anyway, I was away, and while I was away, I guess the world ended, or at least it was supposed to end. Some people said it was going to be World War III, and of course, I did not want missiles to be sent. When I heard, "Oh no, Trump's thinking of missiles," I think it went through all our minds. We're like, "Oh no, no, please don't do this, don't escalate this." Which was the concern. But I saw a number of folks in the limited time I had to check social media out saying honestly kind of crazy stuff, I thought, at least. I guess if we're going to have a nuclear war, maybe it's not that crazy. But I just thought this is a little bit panicky, saying things like, "I regret voting for Trump. Basically repenting of it. I should never have told any of you to vote for Trump," as if Kamala Harris would have been better. And Dave Smith was one, Candace Owens was one, Nick Fuentes, I not that I follow him, but of course, this is like go time for those guys, right? They're like, "Oh man, this is our opportunity. This is our narrative. Like, this is go time." And of course, it wasn't go time. And I'm actually very happy with the way things turned out compared to the way what could have happened. What could have happened, obviously, scared a lot of us. And so this prompted me. I thought, you know, when I get back, I don't know if I'll cover this. I'm not sure. Like, it was still a little bit of an ongoing thing. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, there's not a lot of great resources out there to explain and give a historical background to what actually led to all this. And you could spend a series of podcasts talking about all this, but I thought, you know, I have some requests to talk about it. I'll do it, and I'll probably give you a perspective that you likely aren't hearing in other places as much. And that's because it's driven by a more historical long view. And I think that's really important. I value that. Obviously, I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast value that. Even my critiques of social justice are very driven by historical research and understanding what led to the point that we're at now, and then what are the historical patterns, what could happen given what has happened. So this is not going to be any different. I will confess, though, if it's Eastern or even Middle Eastern history, it's not my strongest point. So I'm thinking back, I had a graduate, or sorry, an undergraduate course in Middle Eastern history. And there's a number of things I learned in that, obviously, that I think pertain. And it was actually that background from like now 16 years ago or more that I was tapping into that made me realize, wow, a lot of the takes out there, especially on X, are just really awful. Like these people, a lot of them don't seem to understand the dynamics geopolitically. And I'm no expert, but hey, I know they're wrong, but they're very sure of themselves. And that just prompted me to say, you know what? I may not know, I may not have all the answers. So if you ask a question in this live chat, I may have to get back to you. I'm thinking of possibly doing a follow-up, and in the follow-up talking more about Zionism and that kind of stuff. I think that's important to this, but it's that's being covered, I think maybe over-covered and probably overplayed by a lot of folks. So it's not my first instinct to cover that, but I may do another episode on that if people are interested. I want to focus on Iran, Israel, and the United States, though. And geopolitically, what just happened? Why did that happen? Why did Trump feel compelled to throw some rockets over there? And Israel, of course, starting this off in a way. I mean, it really is one of those things where you get into parental disputes, right? Or arguments between kids, and the parent has to come in, and it's like, who, you know, he hit me first. Oh yeah, but he said this. Oh yeah, but it's one of those things, right? You can't. Yes, Israel did shoot some rockets that kicked this off, but there's a long history here. And that's what's important to understand. And that's what we're going to get into. And I don't represent all Christians here, but I am a Christian, and I am going to see things in hopefully a Christian way, meaning just war theory, meaning I am American first, meaning the Ordo Amaris means something to me. I care about my country, and I don't want us getting tangled up into wars that aren't ours or don't serve our interests, especially when we have a problem with our own border and our own debt and all kinds of other things. So that's going to play into this obviously as well. But I also have sympathy and compassion for both Iran and Israel and people in general. They're not just, I don't look at things just ideologically. I mean, there's real people in these places that are getting hurt. And I don't know what the casualty levels are now. I think they were estimated to be around 500 or 600 last I checked. That seems, I mean, I don't know. That's what I read, at least. So I haven't looked into that deeply, but 500 or 600 for the Iranian people. And then for Israel, I think it was, I don't know, 15-20, something like that. But with Iran especially, we probably aren't going to know for a little while, if ever, exactly how many. But these are people. These are real people. And this has real world ramifications. And that's why it does matter to an extent. At the same time, though, and I do need to say this before we get into all of it, I don't want, and I don't like the obsession with foreign conflicts and issues. And there definitely has been, and I think it's the right word, an obsession with Israel's conflicts, both coming from a neoconservative kind of hegemony that's been in place for 25 years, at least in DC, and a very pro-Israel lobby there, but also a rising kind of Islamic sympathy coming from those who, and you see this on American university campus, obviously, from those who are pro-Palestinian, quote unquote. And really, I think what it is more than anything is an anti-Israel kind of zeitgeist. And now this is on both the post-liberal left and the post-liberal right. Not obviously every iteration of post-liberalism, but you definitely see these things taking shape and form. And maybe if we have some time, I'll explain why I think that's happening and what that actually is, because I think that's often misdiagnosed. But that does lend itself to a hyperfixation on these things as well. And I think if you're a Washington guy, you want a Washingtonian foreign policy, you want to, as much as possible, scale back foreign involvement, get back to an America first kind of agenda. Some people call this naive. It would take steps to do it. But if that's what you are interested in, which I would say I am someone who is interested in this kind of thing, to do it responsibly, knowing that it takes steps to do it, then there needs to be a focus on our problems that is much greater than a focus on the problems of other countries. And so I'm doing this as carefully as I possibly can, knowing, hey, we just launched some rockets. This affects us. So we do need to talk about it. But at the same time, realizing the goal now should be, okay, now we need to start the deportations, guys, right? That's what we're going to do, because we've temporarily, at the very least, staved off this issue. You might say we kicked the can down the road, but we've managed it. Haven't solved it, but we've managed it, which is probably the best you can hope for in this situation. Let's get some stuff done here. That's kind of my push here. But given all the takes I saw, that so many of them were so egregious, I thought, you know what? Let's walk down Middle Eastern memory lane here. And history is interesting, right? No matter what, it's interesting. So let's just talk about it. That's my thing. So that's what we're going to do. And I will try to get to questions and comments as we go through the podcast as much as I can. But I have a slideshow prepared, the infamous slideshow. I also want to just make two announcements real quick, though, before we get into all of this. And one is, we do have a men's retreat coming up, the Music and Masculinity retreat, musicandmasculinity.com. And this is going to fill up, I think, pretty quick. I'm telling you now, it's just you're going to want to sign up now. I'm just telling you that, because I think that this will fill up. So if you want to check out more about it, go to musicandmasculinity.com. And also, I need to let you know, this is very important. The Church Reform Initiative is putting out the third installment and the last installment in the saga of Summit Church, pastored by J.D. Greer, and Faith Baptist of Knightdale, North Carolina. This is incredible what has happened. We already have over about 260,000 views on YouTube alone of episode one. Episode two has about almost 100,000 views, and then episode three is coming out tonight. This is powerful. You will be, if you watch all three of these, you will be almost in tears at the end. It has a happy ending. Not many of the stories that I talk about do. This one does, and I was very proud to be part of the team and really, you know, arranging this, helping doing the interviews and just being part of it. It has been a wonderful thing. And I really would love to see larger media outlets see this as important, because it is. This is actually, if you watch this documentary and then you read my article that I did for American Reformer, I had a shorter one at The Federalist. I do give you the template. I give you the formula used to sabotage these more conservative, or if you want to, you know, traditional churches, and conform them to a more modernistic kind of progressive template. And this is something you can actually do something about. This is so many of the things I talk about, you're sitting there, you're like, well, I don't know what I can do. I'm just a person in the pew. This is something you can do something about. This is when it comes to your church, if it hasn't already, you can actually see the signs and you can put a foot down and say no more before things really get going. So I would love to see broader coverage of this. It's probably one of the most important things I think I've done in my podcast career, if you want to call it that. And so if there are those of you who have connections, I don't know if you know, you have media connections to podcasters who have large audiences, like, you know, Tucker Carlson's, and even the Tim Pools of the world might be interested in this. I don't know. It's not just a Christian audience that would be interested, but I think that there's a lot of opportunity here for those who see it. And of course, when we launched the first few, it was right before this war. And so, of course, all heads turned towards the war. But I think now that things are hopefully settling down, I would love to get a focus on this. And yeah, so if you have any of those connections, feel free to reach out to me on social media. And hey, wherever the Lord takes it, I'll be satisfied with that. It's obviously his mission. So let's get into the topic for today. I already see that there are comments coming in. Hey, you're not black and white. That's right, Isaiah. I'm not black and white today. The camera works. And just please pray for me, because this computer was not working earlier today. I'm in the market for a new computer. I reset it and everything, but I'm, you know, so let's try to get through this podcast. So just pray for that. But anyway, Ryan says, let's see, American hegemony. We didn't choose to be in the position we're in, but we're in it nevertheless. There's some truth to this. And there is a naive way of looking at foreign policy where it's like, you, without any steps, you can just pull back from everything. That's not true. You can't at least do that responsibly. And there's, you know, there's a lot of things even domestically that I'd love to pull back on. You can't just do it in one shot without there being massive consequences. You have to consider those. Let's see. The USA is already pulling back from global order we created post-World War II, but we're still involved and we'll never get out of involvement completely. I think that's true, says Ryan. I hope you're correct, says Jimmy Starfish. Okay. Well, let's start with some history here. We're going to... Oh, that's not it. Here we go. Here's my fancy slideshow for you. Let's see. And if you're listening, I know I'm going to try my best. There's a few pictures. I'll explain them. But if you're viewing, it's a better experience, I think, especially with the slideshow. If you are a patron, patreon.com/conversations that matter podcast. No, wait, John Harris podcast. I think that's what it is. Let me just make sure here. I think the link is in the info or the title section there. Let's see here. Yes, it's John Harris podcast. You will get access to this particular slideshow so you can have it for yourself. But this is what I prepared to service us as we talk about this. So I want to start really early. Let's start with ancient Iran. And it is pronounced Iran. And one of the first major figures, and this is still a figure revered by Iranians today, is Cyrus the Great. He founded the Achaemenid Empire. And he united Persian tribes and established a vast empire known for its administrative innovations and tolerance of local cultures. And we know about this as Christians because the Bible talks about this. Ezra chapter 1 talks about how the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, and he set out a proclamation that the Lord, the God of heaven, has given to me all the kingdoms of the earth and has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So there is an ancient tie, actually, between the Persians, modern Iranians, and the Israelis, modern Jews. And some of you, I realize some of you think, I don't know exactly where this started, but some people think, well, you know, the modern Jews aren't really Jews and all this. And there's a theological argument for this. There's also a genetic argument for this. I'll just say this, and I could probably go into more detail if people want me to a little bit, but I will say this. If that's true, then Persians aren't Persians either, because Persians, as you will see, went through a lot of changes over the years, including religious changes, including changes in intermarrying with other cultures at times and that kind of thing. I think one of three Persians today or Iranians can trace, they have some trace of Turkish ancestry, actually. So are they not Persians? They think they are, right? And there is obviously a strong connection and cultural inheritance they have that they've had for years. It's not as strong as maybe Jewish people, but it is nonetheless there. The Persians today, Iranians would view themselves as Persians. And then, so you have Darius, the first expands and organizes this empire. Ezra talks about Darius too, right? He issues a decree to do the same thing. He finds out what Cyrus said, and he says, hey, concerning the houses of God in Jerusalem, let the temple be rebuilt. And then you have Alexander the Great that comes in. Alexander the Great conquers Persia, defeats Darius III, and he ends the rule of that particular house, and he ushers in the Hellenistic influence. Now, Daniel 11 talks about this, and as a mighty king will arise, he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, because Alexander the Great's army was divided into four points. And this is one of the amazing things about biblical prophecy, is Daniel knew about this before it actually happened. And if you're watching, that's Darius I in a carving. In 250 BC to 224 AD, the Parthian Empire revives Persian identity by restoring Zoroastrianism. So during the Hellenistic period, Zoroastrianism starts to fade. You have Hellenistic influence, and then it comes back. So there's a rejuvenation of Zoroastrianism. This is also the time you had kings from the east coming, right? And they visit the Messiah. And some think that those are Zoroastrians, potentially. And they expel the Seleucid successors of Alexander, the Parthian Empire does. They resist Roman expansion, notably repelling Mark Antony's invasion circa 36 BC, and after his alliance with Jewish factions against Parthian interests. So there you have Jewish people siding with Mark Antony against the Parthians, and the Parthians win. These are Persians. So then we have a switch, though. We go from Zoroastrianism to Islam, right? So Zoroastrianism still has an impact. There actually are practicing Zoroastrians today in Iran, but it's no influence. It's a cultural relic, apparently. So 224 to 651, the Sasanian Empire rises with the Zoroastrian priest Kartir organizing the Zoroastrian Magi, formalizing religious authority. And this strengthens Persian culture. So there's this thing called Persian culture. But then 602 to 628, Khosrau II seeks alliances with the Byzantine Empire to counter nomadic invasions. So there's invaders coming in, and we need to have an alliance to protect from these people. But the invaders end up winning because 636 to 651, Arab Muslim armies come in, led by generals like Khalid Ibn al-Walid, and they defeat the Sasanian forces, ending Persian rule and introducing Islam. And though Persians resist cultural assimilation, there still is this infusion, and Islam becomes kind of the order of the day. And it looks like my slide is a little cut off, and I don't know why that it does that. So let me see if I can open up an alternative version here that I can look at so I can read for you everything I had here. But we have the Farsi emerging as a distinct language. Farsi is what they speak today in Iran, blending Persian and Islamic influences. And it fosters a unique cultural identity. So the identity that Persians or Iranians have today is a fusion. It's a fusion of Islam and the Persian culture that had been there before. And this means that they actually also have their own unique strain of Islam, which puts them at odds with the Saudis. They are Shiites, and the Saudis are Sunnis. And this is something that actually is an important point to make for the current situation that exists there and why we did what we did last week. Then you have the Seljuk Turks beginning their conquest of Persia in early 11th century with significant control established by 1037. So the Turkish Empire comes in, and you have Genghis Khan coming in later than that. And then you have a Turkish migration into Iran. So now they're blending so they have Hellenistic influence and they have Turkish influence. And there's basically Iran gets reduced, or Persia gets reduced to this nomadic empire during this time. And you have the white sheep Turkmen against the black sheep Turkmen. And so it's not this cohesive empire. It's more fractured. It's you know, wanderers. It's sheep herders and this kind of thing. It's kind of a clannish setup. And then in 1501 rather, so we're talking the Middle Ages now, Ismail the First founds the Safavid dynasty and declares Shiism the state religion. So now Shiism, the Islamic form that took root there, becomes the dominating force, distinguishing Iran from Sunni majority neighbors and embedding the 12th Shiism's belief in the return of the 12th Imam. So the turn of the 12th Imam is this belief that there's a messianic figure coming, and this factors right into Iran's foreign policy today. And there's a spiritual and political kind of dimension where Iran needs to set up a favorable condition for the return of this 12th imam. And part of this is they're seeking global hegemony, and you could say, well, they're not doing that yet. Right. Well, but they want Middle Eastern hegemony to some extent. They are at odds with some of the countries around them, which I'll get into, but Israel obviously being one of the major enemies. So this is this 12th Imam belief becomes pervasive. 1501 to 1736, the Safavid rule sees corruption with harem enticements undermining the Shahs. So the Shahs become corrupt in the harem, and there's drug use, and there's obviously sexual perversion and so forth. And this creates a disjointment between the Shahs, who are the kings — Shah just means king or ruler — and those who they govern. So the nomadic tribal peoples have a tension with the imperial wing, and this leads to centuries of instability. And then in 1800, the Ayatollahs surpass the corrupt Shahs in influence, legitimizing rulers and issuing legal rulings, laying the groundwork for theocratic power. The Ayatollahs are just the religious scholars, essentially. And this is what Iran is now ruled by, is Ayatollahs. Okay. This is, you hear about the Ayatollah Khamenei. You're hearing about a cleric, a Muslim cleric, a Farsi speaking, Shiite believing cleric that dominates a theocracy, which is Iran today. Right. So this is where the roots of all of this come from. Then you have Western influence starting in the late 1800s through obviously the 20th century. And it starts economically. OK, so 1890 to 1892, you have British tobacco concessions fueling what became the tobacco protest. There was even a jihad called against the British. And this is the beginning of suspicions of foreign or Western influence, which also affects us today. The British are trying to take advantage of us, that kind of thing, right? And then in 1905 to 1906, the Constitutional Revolution establishes a parliament and constitutional monarchy, introducing a democratic ideals amid resistance to foreign control. So you have the infusion of some of these foreign structures, these Western or modern structures, you could even say liberal kind of structures. And at the same time, though, there's resistance in Iran to some of these things. 1906, you can see, by the way, a lot of parallels with Turkey. If you ever study the history of Turkey and the Young Turks and that kind of thing, there's a lot of parallels here. 1907, Britain and Russia divide Iran into spheres of influence via the Anglo-Russian Convention, undermining national sovereignty. So you had not just the English, but the Russians are also in Iran. They're, at this point, it's primarily oil that they're after, and they divide Iran up economically. So you already have divisions happening in Iran. This time, though, it's not divisions socially. This is economic divisions. 1919 to 1921, post-World War I, Britain attempts to dominate Iran through the Anglo-Persian Agreement. Rebellions against the Russians' influence persists. And then 1925, Reza Shah Pahlavi, inspired by Ataturk, who's the leader in Turkey, his secular reforms in Turkey, deposes the dynasty, enforcing secular laws, and suppresses tribal structures to modernize Iran. And so these factions have existed, by the way, going back as far as the beginning of Western influence. The same factions that exist in Iran today have a start back then. You have pro-Western, pro-modern forces, and you have those who want the 12th Imam, who want Islamic domination, Sharia law, all of that. That is where Iran is at today, and that's been a struggle for a while. And if you don't understand that, you will not understand why we did what we did. You won't understand our foreign policy. You have to understand there is internal instability in Iran. Just like there's an internal instability, it's not as unstable perhaps, but there's an internal instability in Israel. Israel has religious Jews, and it has those who are very secular forming a government together. And it's kind of held together by a mutual enemies list and mutual survival. But they are very at odds with each other. Iran has a similar issue with modern influence and Islam. Turkey does too. A lot of these countries do. So you have in 1946, Shah Gavaim rebels in a bloodbath against the Kurds. So the Kurds are a minority faction with different beliefs here. And I probably didn't need to mention this, but it's part of their history. The representative arm passes laws rejecting foreign concessions following Soviet withdrawal from Iran post-World War II. This is all post-World War II. The protections for the Kurds aren't there. So the Kurds have a protection from the Soviets. It's removed. And then there's a bloodbath against the Kurds. 1949. So now we are in the time of Israel is ascending as beginning its ascension as a country. 1949, there's a planning organization set up, Sazemina Barnama, and it's established to drive economic and social modernization. And this spirit will basically impact Iran for the next few decades. You have Then the timeline kind of diverges and we have U.S. and Iran, and then I have Israel and Iran and their relationship. So we'll talk about this. And there's a picture of Richard Nixon with the Shah of Iran. Doesn't look very Muslim, right? Doesn't look, I mean, looks kind of Western, right? 1830 to 1900, the American Presbyterians had already sent missionaries in who established 31 schools in Iran. They set up hospitals as well. 1941 to 1945, FDR provides aid via Lend-Lease. And by 1953, the U.S. had provided $1 billion in aid, eclipsing Britain and Russian influence as Iran's primarily foreign partner. So the U.S. becomes very influential in Iran. Now, this is history you may not know. It's also important for understanding where why we're at where we are today. But Iran and the U.S. haven't always been this opposed to each other. 1946, though, Alan Dulles persuades the Shah to remove the prime minister over fears of communist influence, aligning Iran with U.S. Cold War policies. So this is partially driven by the Cold War. Now, let me make a big point here, and you'll see this a little bit. But our involvement with Iran does not start with Israel, okay? Our concern over Iran and Iran's policies do not start with Israel. Our concern with Iran starts with the Cold War. And our involvement starts even before that a little bit. But our official government state directed foreign policy starts with concerns over the Cold War primarily. Okay. Obviously, yes, there was some oil interests and those kinds of things, but we do not want the Russians, who have been involved in Iran before and have a history there, to use Iran for their own benefit as a colonial, state underneath them, which they very well could easily have done. So this, as Britain kind of exits the world stage, we fill that void during the Cold War to counter the Soviet Union. This is where we actually start to get tangled up. And like I said, if you want to go back, and I want to go back to a more humble foreign policy, you have to undo some of these wires. And it's a very difficult thing when you have a history now of being involved in a country. So we get involved in Iran. And so the Shah visits the U.S., cementing anti-communist ties. By 1950, the U.S. relies heavily on Iranian oil and to fuel its post-war economy. And in 1953, this is a big, big thing here, too. This is another big point I have to make. But in 1953, the CIA and MI6 orchestrate a coup to oust Prime Minister Mohammad, I think it's Mozadeh, after his nationalization attempt of the Anglo-Iranian Iranian oil company, AIOC. This is the company that England had in Iran to manage its oil. So you have the prime minister, this is not the Shah, this is the prime minister in this sort of liberal republic form. He says, you know what, we're getting a bad raw deal from Great Britain. Let's nationalize this. Let's take the oil for ourselves. And the CIA... And so the British and the Americans say, you know what? No. And we don't like that. Gary Sick notes that this coup abruptly and permanently ended Americans' political innocence with respect to Iran, and the Shah then becomes Iran. So what basically happens in all this is Iran develops from this point forward a severe mistrust of the United States with a certain class. It doesn't mean the United States influence ceases. It doesn't mean there's not still friendly cooperation with the Shah on some level, but there is a deep mistrust that's formed at this point. Now, some say this is overblown and a lot of it is shrouded in some mystery, but it does seem we were involved in a political influence at the very least that now the Iranian people view as a coup, and they do not like the United States for this. And so I want to emphasize something here. Yes, Iran does not like us for our support of Israel, but Iran's distaste for America started long before anything related to Israel. So that's another important point for me to make. And that's something that I think people ought to understand in this whole conflict. So then we have from 1970 to 79, the U.S. grants a $200,000 loan with stipulations deepening economic ties but reinforcing Iran's dependency. So when I say the Shah, Iran becomes the Shah becomes Iran. Getting rid of the prime minister means the Shah now is our We have economic deals with the Shah. We have advisory roles with the Shah. We don't want the Shah going under communist influence. So we have a relationship with the Shah. We fund things in Iran, in Iran. We tell the Shah that he needs to do what we want him to do if we're going to give him money and that kind of thing. Henry Kissinger was all over this. And the Shah becomes kind of the figurative head here for Iran. More than figurative, he's the actual head of Iran, the governmental head. But this doesn't mean all of Iran feels the way the Shah feels. But we have a generally decent relationship. Even during this time, the Shah had a nuclear program from 1970 to 79 that employed 500 people. His regime, human rights abuses. During this period, there are human rights abuses. There's imprisonments. There's all these issues, but we don't really get involved in these things. Then what happens is the Iranian Revolution. This is a big, big event. This is something that has to be understood to understand what just happened. The Iranian Revolution is led by religious and populist forces. They overthrow the Shah. That's our lifeline. Remember, that's our connection. And the Revolutionary Guard forms at this point. And 5,000 officers are executed in purges, consolidating the Islamic Republic. The U.S. Embassy then has a hostage crisis that lasts 444 days. There's an interesting story here, by the way. Brian McClanahan did a podcast on this. And I thought it was interesting that so Reagan's real election team, essentially, there's some thought that they, and it seems like there's some evidence, they actually cut a deal with Iran to release the hostages after the election so that it would benefit Ronald Reagan and not Jimmy Carter. Whether Reagan knew about this, I don't know, but this probably cost Carter the election, the fact that we had these hostages and he just seemed unable to do anything about it. So you have now the wing that is very mistrustful of us taking control of Iran, 1979 to 2015. And this colors the rest of our foreign policy. The U.S. imposes sanctions on Iran for 36 years, targeting its nuclear program and economy, aiming to isolate the Islamic Republic there. 2005, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is elected. This is fueled by economic discontent that bolsters Iran's defiance of U.S. policies. 2006, 2007, there's an intensified sanctioning under President Bush and Obama, then aims for regime change, escalating tensions. 2012 sanctions trigger 50% inflation, crippling Iran's educated middle class and deepening economic hardship. So you can see that there's some resentment the common people of Iran have towards the United States. The sanctions are hurting them, and they're hurting the common people. And you know, this is there's a hatred. There's a hatred for whether Israel's involved or not. There's a hatred there. Israel does get very involved though, and I'm going to show you that in a minute. 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action forms. That's Obama's nuclear deal, which limits Iran's uranium enrichment and lifts sanctions. Netanyahu's Congress makes a speech in 2015, calls it a mistake. This strains our ties with Israel, and then Iran violates this program in 2018 because they start enriching uranium up to 60%. And the reason we know about that is because of the Mossad, because of Israeli intelligence, which I'll show you. That's an amazing story I'll share with you in a moment. So Biden seeks the JCPOA revival when he gets into office. So Trump gets into office, pulls us out. Biden wants to revive this. And one of the things he's willing to concede is he's going to make the Revolutionary Guard not designated as a terror group, because we designate them as a terror group. And for good reason, Iran is funding much of the terrorism in the Middle East, including in the rockets that went into Israel on October 7th. Right. This is one of the problems that we've had. And so we listed the Revolutionary Guard as they're a terrorist organization. Well, Biden said, let's take that off the table. Let's get back into this deal. But it doesn't pan out because Trump had already withdrawn in 2018 after there was evidence from the Mossad, from their espionage that showed that Iran was lying about their capabilities. And then Trump puts maximum pressure sanctions on Iran. So he punishes them big time for lying to us, for lying to the world. So, and this is one of the things there, and there is, in Islam, there is a doctrine that allows you to lie for a good reason, essentially. And Iran lies. This is in keeping, I guess, with their foreign policy and their religious beliefs. And this becomes a pretext for us to be even harder on Iran. In 2020, Trump orders the assassination of the Revolutionary Guard's Qasem Soleimani. You may have heard that name before. This is also a very big deal. Qasem was a mastermind behind much of the terrorism that killed not just Israelis, but Americans and others. 2011 to 2025, that whole period, Trump says over 50 times that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. And I want to say that loud and clear for everyone to hear, because I saw people saying, I regret my vote for Trump. I never wanted this. I thought he was going to pull us out and all of this. Trump has been, if there's anything Trump's been consistent on, it has been this. He will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. I don't know how much more clearly I can say it. When the White House published a quote list that had just quote after quote after quote, starting in 2011, this has been a big deal for Trump. So don't tell me, if you're Candace Owens or whoever, don't tell me you didn't know, like Dave Smith, I'm regretting my vote for Trump. This isn't what I voted for. You did vote for it. Now, you voted for other things too that are good, but you did vote for it. And I think Trump's instincts are very good generally, even on foreign policy. I do think it's beyond what I'd like. He does see himself, I think, as the arch deal maker, which I think gives him a positivity. This is the art of the deal, right? He thinks he can go in there and he can talk people. He can work the boardroom into doing what he wants, because oftentimes he can. And he thinks he can do that with these feuds that go back centuries in the Middle East. And oftentimes you cannot. You cannot reach a final agreement. You can manage a problem, perhaps, and that's what I think he's managed to do, but you're not going to come up with the end-all arrangement, which he talks that way sometimes. Like, we've totally decimated their nuclear capabilities. It's the end for them. It's, well, they're, you know, we're going to be talking about this in the coming years. It's a feud. You're not going to just solve it overnight like this, but Trump has a lot of positivity about his abilities to do that kind of thing. And so this does probably create situations where we become more involved in global affairs than perhaps we should be, because we think we can solve these things. It's also good for Trump's political. He doesn't have to seek re-election, but still, it's good for his poll numbers. I think his poll numbers are higher right now than they've been in a long time. J.D. Vance's poll numbers are high. I mean, he's looking really good. Politically, what he did, what he was able to pull off, was a brilliant move. That's now... long term, this just manages the issue, but I get it. It's a big, I put on X that is, it was a big Trump W. It's like, this is a big Trump W if he's able to pull this off. And I have all these people, you know, saying they're screenshotting my tweet and, you know, like it's going to come back to haunt me or something. And I'm saying, I'm not saying I agree. I'm not saying I would have even launched, I would have tried everything not to launch those missiles. And I'll explain why, hopefully, at the end. But you can't say that this isn't a big political win for him. This is a huge political win for him. So anyway, 2019, Iranian-backed militias kill U.S. contractor in Iraq. And this prompts U.S. and Israeli strikes on Revolutionary Guard-linked targets. You may have remembered this from 2019. I remember that. And let's go through the same timeline now, and let's talk about Israel. Okay, so that's the United States. I haven't even really talked about Israel much, right? And you're already getting a clear picture of why there's animosity, why there's a problem, why there's a history, without even mentioning Israel. But if you want to get a full picture, you have to mention Israel, because Israel is a big part of why we were involved in what happened last week and why we're involved now. So 1947 to 1979, Iran votes against the UN. Partition plan for Palestine. Iran doesn't want Israel modern state forming because they're with all the other Muslims. Now, this is something you have to understand about Middle Eastern foreign policy. There's two coalitions that I'm going to be sharing with you. One coalition involved Israel and Iran and basically other Middle Eastern countries against the Saudis, against the Arabian Peninsula. Another coalition involves Israel and the Arabian Peninsula against in the Saudis against Iran. And you might say that they're flipped, right? Israel's involved in both, but it's a different cast of characters, and that is true. And we've gone from one arrangement to another arrangement. And in both arrangements, part of the dynamic has been that these Muslim nations, whether Shiite or Sunni, cannot say anything against the Palestinians without suffering backlash. They're afraid to do it. Their populations support the Palestinians because they're Muslim. They're always going to support the Palestinians over a secular Jewish state. It's or a religious Jewish state. It's just the way it is. So this is the dance they have to do. If they're negotiating with Israel, if they want an economic deal, if they want a military deal, they have to sometimes even in secret make the deals without it getting out, because it's going to look bad, because they got to support. They always have to look like they're supporting the Palestinians. This is part of the dance of Middle Eastern geopolitics. So you're going to see this with Iran. So they vote. Let's see. So where did I put that? Did I lose it? I thought I just had it. Okay. So they vote to against the partition plan in 1948. Iran, however, is the second Muslim majority country to recognize Israel. So how does that make sense, right? So after it happens, they recognize Israel. Yep, Israel, they're legitimate. Then in 1949, they vote against Israel's admission to the UN. So you look at that and you're like, how does that make any sense? That's how it makes sense. This is what I just explained. So they fit into Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion's Alliance of the Periphery, and trade with one another, including oil and joint military projects like Project Flower, which was a joint project, if you can believe it, between Iran and Israel to build missiles. So they have joint military initiatives between them. And this Alliance of the Periphery is sort of a loose alliance that Israel has with nations that are against Saudi. I guess you could say Shiites versus Sunnis, right? Which is flipped now. 1979, though, the Islamic Revolution happens, and Iran adopts an anti-Israel stance, supports proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, and they become the number one source of funding terrorism in that region. Israel decides not to pay Iran $250 million debt. That's a sore spot. And in 1980 to 1988, Israel supports Iran, though, despite all this happening, in the Iran-Iraq War with arms and advisors. That's an amazing thing. I think it was like 50 advisors Israel sent. They sold them missiles and guns and things so they can fight the Iraq. This is the constant geopolitical situation in the Middle East. It's this constant reworking of alliances to go after the threat that looks the most scary. In the 1990s, Israel then becomes alarmed, though, that Iran could really get a nuclear weapon. And Israel pursues, and this is sort of a potential thing because it's shrouded in some mystery, but the Samson option, which is Israel has nuclear weapons. They're not going to tell you how many. And if you attack them, they'll do a mutually assured destruction. So the threat needs to be present so people decide not to attack them. They have to be too dangerous to attack. And you have to understand that the population of Israel is what, not 10 million? Population of Iran is like 90 million, something like that. You have to understand Israel is surrounded by countries incredibly with more populations in them, with more of everything, really, and that don't necessarily like Israel, that favor the Palestinians over Israel. And this makes them feel very threatened. They are also very threatened because of what they went through in the Holocaust and their experience in Europe and other places. They are always there's a fear that they need. I mean, that's the whole sort of rudimentary issue with Zionism, right? That's why it formed. Zionism is this, let's give a place for Jewish people to live, because it seems like they become persecuted in many of the countries that they live in. And there's those who are even anti-Semitic, quote unquote, or those who don't care for Jews, we'll say, who actually even become part of this, because they say, yeah, give them a place so they'll leave us alone. And there are, I'm not saying those guys drove it, but there is a sensitivity there. There's also, this forms all pre-dispensational theology, by the way. There's a number of covenant theologians. In fact, I'm not sure if it I think it is the majority view. I don't quote me on that yet because I haven't looked fully, but I know guys like you know, many of the Puritans like Increase Mather, Jonathan Edwards, if you brought back further to the reformers, even guys like John Calvin, Samuel Rutherford, these guys all seemed to signal that there was going to be an ingathering of Jewish people that would happen in the future. And so there's a bunch of covenantal people actually who make up the ranks of the early Zionists. This comes together before there's a fully orbed dispensational theology. There, you could say there's echoes of dispensationalism. In fact, there's a book on my desk. I've been doing a bunch of reading on, I just finished a book on covenant theology. This is a book that I've been told I should read that has, I guess, dispensational. Some covenant guys say it's debunked, but it's got some dispensational beliefs, I guess, that preceded Darby. But anyway, before Darby, we'll say, there's this sort of spirit of the Jewish people need a homeland. This gets going until you get the before Balfour Declaration. And what was that, in like 1910 or so? And it's this commitment of the British to find a place for the Jewish homeland. The Holocaust is what really justifies this more than anything else. And there are many proposals for where this could be. Palestine was not the only place, but that becomes one of the places because, hey, they have ancestral ties there. There's already some Jewish people living in the area. This makes sense. It's under British rule. It was taken from the Turks before that. You know, you had the Crusader states and all going back, but this is kind of a homecoming, and this is where they want to come. And so there's a number of factors that went into this. But there, the return, if that's how the Zionists would frame it, or you could say the settlement, that's how a non-Zionist might frame it, of these Jewish people, mostly from Europe in the Middle East, becomes a sore point. And it becomes a sore point, not just because they're Jewish, but also because you have to understand from an Islamic perspective, they represent a colonial outpost. Before, it was the Byzantines versus the Muslims, right? And in Europe versus the Muslims, and you had crusades. And it was Christianity versus Islam. Then it became liberalism, right? A lot of these countries went liberal. And that's what we live in today. Israel is basically a liberal outpost. You could say of Europe, because Europe is the one that drove the formation and the ability to, I mean, it was England who had the land there, of Israel to have a body politic and a government there. And so this becomes a European outpost, in at least there's a cooperation there in the Middle East, a liberal democracy in a very illiberal area. This is going to come up later as I show you what Richard Nixon said for why we support Israel. But from the Muslim perspective, they think in centuries. They're still thinking back to, yeah, we're against the West, we're against the Christians, we're against the iteration of that now. Is this, it's Europe, it's Israel, but there's obviously also a special hatred for Jewish people that goes back even farther. So this is the complex matrix that we're living in. And this would all be there without any dispensational theology. Okay. People need to understand that. Maybe we'll do a podcast on that if that really becomes an issue people want to double down on. But dispensational theology does become a way to kind of justify American involvement for the simple reason that the land promises given to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant. This is the Ted Cruz interview that he had with Tucker Carlson last week. Those land promises are interpreted in a dispensational framework as having a future fulfillment in a literal, physical Jewish state. Now, here's the thing. Here's the secret. This does not actually obligate the United States or any Christians to support the modern state of Israel. Even on a dispensational framework, it doesn't obligate anyone. But if you frame the modern state of Israel as, if you sell that as these guys, this is the modern coming in, the ingathering, and then you say, look at the way that they defeated their enemies in 1967, and then again in 1973, in a miraculous way, we weren't even really supportive of Israel in those early years, and they could go it alone and defeat their enemies. It was incredible. That it looks like miracles. It looks like God intervening. Go watch some of the, you know, I used to watch the History Channel, their dogfight series on some of the things the IDF Air Force would do with like two planes against, you know, a bunch of MiGs, and you're like, there's no way the Israelis are going to win, and then they win. Stuff like that is crazy. And that has been really during the 1980s has been packaged and sold to American Christians, mostly of a dispensationalist persuasion, to get them to make the connection between, look, God's got a favor on Israel now. This is the ingathering that you've wanted. But there's nothing in dispensational framework that obligates you to necessarily support Israel with American foreign policy. So that's my framework for working through this. And I'm going to have, by the way, I'll just mention this. I am going to have a number of episodes next week on dispensationalism, on amillennialism, and on postmillennialism, and possibly an episode on the connection between some religious right Christians, Zionist Christians in the United States during the 80s, and Israeli, conservative Israeli forces wanting to create a stronger connection for security's sake. They want the United States on their side, and this is a point that they can use to gain ascendance on the right. But that doesn't explain, obviously, why the Democratic Party has been so supportive of Israel too for many years. It's not, you know, that it's the liberal order. That's really the primary animating feature that has made us support Israel, and the Holocaust experience. Okay, so anyway, I figured I would just get that off my chest, and we'll keep going with the history here. So you have Israel having this alarm, though, that, hey, look, if Iran has a nuke, that's not good. These guys want the 12th Imam. They're not exactly our friends. They could use it on us. And if they have that, once a country gets the nuke, it's like game over. Like, look at North Korea, right? They got the nuke, and it's like, oh, man, now we can't just it makes our options limited. It's dangerous. And so Israel wants to do everything they can to keep Iran from having a nuke. And we want to do everything we can to keep Iran from having a nuke, not just because of the threat to Israel, but also the threat to our own interests in the Middle East. And more than that, I mean, I think legitimately think that the people who are running Iran now are theocratic radicals who would conform the whole world to their thinking if they could, if they had the opportunity. And so this is what's going on in the minds of people like Donald Trump. 2000s, Qassem Soleimani, who I just mentioned was killed in 2019, but he had a ring of fire strategy to encircle Israel with proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and then build tunnels for attacks and fund cyber attacks on Israel infrastructure. 2018, there's in the archive, the Cohen archive heist. This is an incredible story, by the way. And there's some good books on it that I actually just read two books one on this situation. One of them, though, goes into this in detail. And it is like a James Bond. It deserves a movie called Target Tehran. You can go check that out. But there's this heist of these archives. And so you have a group from Israel sneak into an Islamic warehouse. Iranian warehouse. They find these archives. They had to like go into this drum, I think it was, where they were keeping these archives and like, you know, do this whole, we don't know exactly because some of it's secret, but they had to get around cameras and they had to like drill into or burn into box truck thing and then go into it, get the archives. They had to first find out where the archives were, and they bring them back to Israel, and they're detected a few hours afterwards. So it was too late for the Iranians to do anything. They were already on route back. And this gets into the hands of their Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad. And what it reveals is that Iran has been lying for years, for decades, about their nuclear program and their ambitions. Surprise, surprise. So the Mossad decides they're going to wait. They're going to sit on this, and they're going to wait for the opportune moment to introduce this to the world. And they do. And that's when Trump decides, all right, we're pulling out of this agreement with Iran. They've already broken it. What's the point? And we're going to put more sanctions on them to punish them. And I think Trump's mindset is they only understand strength. So that's all we can do it. So this peace through strength. So this reveals Iran's secret Ahmad project, proving nuclear weapons intent, and Netanyahu uses evidence to expose their lies. In 2020, we have the Abraham Accords. Now, I mentioned to you earlier David Ben-Gurion's Alliance of the Periphery. This is like the flip side of that. This is like an opposite alliance. This is the Abraham Accords are Trump's deal brokered with Israel, with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And there were also non-public deals with the Saudis that Israel conducted. And these are all against Iran. So guess what? The Saudis don't want Iran. They don't like Iran. The United Arab Emirates doesn't like Iran. They're all afraid of Iran. And they're willing to side with the U.S. and Israel against Iran. That's what's happening right now. But especially the Saudis, have to be careful, because if they talk about this, then it might be perceived that they are not supportive of the Palestinians. That becomes kind of the issue here. 2020 to 2021, you have the Bennett-Barnett campaign, where Mossad sponsors sabotage, destroys centrifuges, and assassinates scientists like Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, if I can say it right. And he's like the Oppenheimer, I guess, scientist of Iran. And this is the story of Israel and Iran with nuclear weapons. Mossad keeps spoiling the efforts of Iran to have a nuke. That's basically what keeps happening. So you might wonder why. You know, I saw a bunch of guys on X being like, hey, why is it that it's like we're always told every 5 years? Sorry, I shouldn't do the dumb voice, right? That's like the dumb voice. And because it's a legitimate question, but so many people were saying this, I was like, guys, you know, why is it that we're always 5 years away from a bomb with Iran? It's always like 5 years away. It never changes. And then it's like we're a year away potentially. We don't know, but it's close. We've been told this for 30 years. We're sick of it. Well, the reason that you've been told that for 30 years, there's two options here, right? One option is that the United States and Israel are just forming this. AIPAC is forming an alliance to lie to you, right? Or the other option is actually they have been close to nuclear weapons, as their own intelligence says, and Mossad keeps spoiling their efforts. They keep assassinating people. They keep doing espionage. And so Iran has been forced to go underground to these super secure areas that Israel rockets and so forth can't get to. And this is the situation that we were in last week, where Israel was like, we can't take them out this time. We need the U.S. to have bunker busting bombs because we can't do it. That's I think, given all the evidence we have, that's probably the more accurate read. There's the more conspiratorial read. And I'm not saying conspiracies are always inaccurate, but there aren't sources for it as much as you could probably find embellishments and so forth of people who are too, you know, afraid of Iran, saying that they're more dangerous than they are. But let's focus on what we know. What we do know is, yes, they have been close many times, and they keep getting foiled. They keep getting setbacks. And that was part of the Bennett-Barnett campaign. 2021 to 2023, though, Iran bars the IAEA inspectors. So remember, we pulled out of that deal, but it doesn't mean the deal was ended. There were other countries involved, and Iran finally pulls out. They shut off the cameras that are supposed to be monitoring their uranium enrichment, and they start enriching uranium to near weapons grade, defying the JCPOA is the deal they were in. So they defy the inspectors that are supposed to be looking into this kind of thing. And that does sound similar, I will admit, to what Saddam Hussein did, right? So it's like the whole WMD scare and all that. He's like, well, he's not letting inspectors in, so what's he doing? Then you have 2023. This is another element you have to add to this, or else you can't understand fully the situation. China's also involved in this. However many fears we have of Iran, our fears of China and Russia, and Russia to a lesser extent, but China, are exceptionally more, because both those countries have nuclear weapons. And in some of our war simulations, China wins. And I know it's a paper tiger and all that. Yes, but they still have a pretty strong military. And it was looking pretty bad under Biden. So China has a, their colonial interests are all over the world. And we don't want them, just like we didn't with the Russians in Iran, we don't want them forming these close ties either. China, though, in 2023, brokers a deal between the Saudis and Iran. There's a diplomatic restoration. Remember, I told you that, hey, the Saudis and Israel are forming a relationship that's true against Iran. Well, China is brokering deals to try to restore the Saudis with Iran. That goes contrary to our interests, to Israel's interests. So this has become also something we're keeping our eye on. And then in 2024, I meant Iran. That's a typo on my part. I'm sorry about that. I meant Iran there. 2024, Iran sells missiles to Russia. So this was the fear of World War III, was if we have a country that's got a connection to Russia and China, and they see this as an opportunity, and we send missiles, is it going to spark a big war? Is Russia going to come in and say, you know what, we're going to back Iran up? Is China going to come in and say, you know what, we're going to back Iran up? And this is something we don't have all the information to, and this was something I was super afraid of, I shouldn't say super afraid, but this was something I was cautious of, and I think many of us were hesitant about. It's like, is this going to create a pretext for backlash against us from these bigger countries? And I think maybe an invasion of Taiwan would do that. There's part of me that wants to, like, I still wouldn't have wanted to send those missiles. I would have tried anything I could to, if something like that's going to happen, Israel should do it. If we want to sell Israel weapons, okay, you know, maybe we don't want them having certain technologies. I don't know, but figure out a way for Israel to do it if possible. Those are my instincts, but Trump also has instincts. And even though I don't like the fact that he didn't go to Congress for support, even though I know that's like, that's not even a thing anymore, I guess. There's part of me that's like willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and just trust his instincts on it. Even though, yes, I would not have done it in his situation. And looking back, I still don't like it and wouldn't have done it. But I think I can understand what he might have been looking at and why he might have done it. And I'm going to show you more evidence for why he probably thought it was a good move in just a moment. So let's see. So we have in 2024, we have Israeli airstrikes target Natanz and other nuclear sites with U.S. supplied weapons in Iran. They kill IR Revolutionary Guard commanders, scientists. Iran retaliates with missiles. So that was just last year. And then I want to wrap some of this together for you. So why the strikes? Why did this happen last week? Well, let me give you the short-term answer here. The U.S. and Israel struck Iran's nuclear sites. And the reason was because this was high reward and low risk for them. It was an operation that they could do, and it would likely delay Iran's nuclear program by a decade or more. That's at least what they think. So this is management. This isn't people who expect, well, this didn't solve anything. It wasn't meant to. It was meant to manage a problem. That's all they can hope for. Okay. So, and that's why I was saying it's a win for Trump, even though people are like, this isn't a final solution to this problem. And I'm like, I know it's not, but you tell me what the solution is. You got two countries that are dead set against each other. You have other countries in the area that mistrust this one country. You have this country that has ambitions beyond even Israel. What are you going to do? Regime change isn't a good idea. So what are you going to do? Anyway, Iran's military doctrine collapses here. Right? They relied heavily on proxy forces like Hezbollah and the Houthis, but they're not strong anymore because Israel's been kicking tail. So their proxies are weakened, especially after Assad's fall in Syria. So this dismantles Iran's regional deterrence. So they had some alliance with Syria. They could move weapons into Syria and move it into that ring of fire area. They can't do that anymore. So they're hampered in their ability to supply the enemies of Israel. Iran's nuclear ambitions obviously are also... So this makes them more desperate too, right? So this is, if they're going to do anything, it's probably going to... Nuclear is a better option. So it's going to be rockets or it's going to be a nuclear bomb or something. So their uranium enrichment reaches 60%. That's far exceeding civilian needs. It seems clear to us, to our intelligence, that they're after a bomb. And part of me doesn't blame them for this. I'll just say, make a little aside here. The reason I say that is because put yourself in their position too. They look at how North Korea is treated versus how Iraq was treated. One has a nuclear bomb. If you have a nuclear bomb, people respect you. So you can understand from Iran's perspective why this wouldn't just be even an offensive thing. This is also a defensive measure. Maybe our enemies will leave us alone if they know we have the bomb. So anyway, they pursue it, but they lie about it and all the rest. And then Iran could, there's intelligence indicating apparently that Iran could soon produce multiple warheads using fortified underground facilities. Only the U.S. munitions are capable of penetrating these sites effectively. So you need the United States to do something. There's a strategic timing element here. That's why this is high reward and low risk. There's open skies over Syria. There's degraded Iranian air defenses. And this creates a rare opportunity that's been there since February. We could dismantle their proxy network further and reduce Iran's capabilities to respond. This is part of a broader U.S. strategic priority. Regime change isn't feasible or desirable, and we have to focus on China because they're the big strategic threat, and particularly regarding Taiwan. So we can't get too invested, but we can do this. And this would put Trump in a position. Think of the payoff, right? This is the high reward part of this. It puts Trump in a position where his poll numbers go up. He has more ability to do what he wants to do on the border. He has more ability to get all his other his domestic arrangements achieved. It gets him a stronger foreign policy position. It delays that issue so that he doesn't have to think about it, and he can focus on other foreign policy concerns, including the situation in Ukraine. There's so many wins in this, and it seems like Trump was able to pull it off, which is incredible to me. So that's the long term. Now, let me give you the short term. That's the short term. Let me give you the long term of all this. The long term is that here are some lessons to pull out. There are nuclear tensions there, and the reason is Iran's uranium enrichment and resistance to inspections stem from mistrust and historical defiance, viewing the United States as an imperialist power. Okay? That's what's going on here. I think there's a defensive element too here, but there's this tension is because there is a mistrust. Iran does not trust the United States. The United States does not trust Iran. That would be there whether Israel was there or not, but Israel, of course, that whole situation exacerbates it about 10 times. You have proxy wars. Support for Hezbollah or the Houthis in 2024 to 2025 reflects Shiite ideology and imperial ambitions framed as resistance to Israel and Saudi Arabia. So you got the quest for dominance in the Middle East and the using proxy wars to do it from Iran. So this is something that you've seen develop over time. And there's a religious reason for it. Then you also have economic unrest, domestic protests, and economic-driven defiance push Iran to escalate regionally to deflect internal criticism, mirroring historical patterns, meaning that Iran has always had an instability within it. In fact, I think in what was 2011 or something, there was some like potential, there was a revolution forming in Iran against the 1979 revolution. And I think it was called the Green Revolution. And we could have done something, but Obama didn't do it. We could have tried to help a regime change happen, but Obama didn't do it. And maybe he made the right decision. Maybe he didn't. My foreign policy instincts are no on those kinds of things. Try to untangle yourself from that. But this was a possibility at that time. And when Iran has a threat, though, that is shared by everyone because bombs are being dropped, it unites the country. So that's another factor here. So that's the long view of all of this. Now, there's so much more to be said, but I want to play, and before I get to questions, I want to play for you a clip. This is from Richard Nixon, and this later in his life, so this must be the 90s. And I want you to hear why Richard Nixon says the United States supports Israel. What's the reason behind it? Why does the United States do what they do here? This is what I've been saying. If you've listened to this podcast, I've been saying this for a long time. And I kind of was happy. It was vindicated to hear Richard Nixon say the same thing that I've been saying. So here it is.
You make the observation in your book, and you say that you have said it many times when you were president of the United States, that no president is ever going to desert Israel, right?
Correct. I put it more bluntly. I said, as I told congressional leaders during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, No American president will let Israel go down the tube.
All right.
Democrat or Republican, it's not an issue.
That is stated fairly categorically, and yet in your book you make it clear at the same time that Israel really is not of any enormous strategic value to the United States anymore.
That's correct.
So why then would the United States continue to burden itself with huge loans, in some cases outright grants, to the Israelis, jeopardize possibly young American fighting men, when there is no strategic value involved, or little strategic
because
value.
The United States is concerned by more than strategic values. That's maybe a weakness, but it's the way we are. And there are moral issues involved here. We don't have an alliance with Israel, as you know. They're not an ally of the United States in the technical sense. But we have a bond to Israel that's much stronger. It's a moral commitment. A moral commitment because of what happened during the Holocaust, and a moral commitment because it is a democracy, the only democracy in that area. And under the circumstances, that is why American presidents and the American people in the future will support all out the survival of Israel if it's attacked.
You've always been a very tough, pragmatic man. And I just wonder if you were the president of Israel and you heard Richard Nixon talking that way, or for that matter, heard any sitting American president talk that way, and say, but there's really no strategic value anymore, how much faith would you place in that kind of a moral commitment if push really came to shove?
If I were the president of Israel, I put a great deal of faith in it because of the track record of the United States, and also because he would know that that is the way the American people are. There is no doubt whatever of our commitment to Israel.
There you have it. That's, I couldn't have said it better myself. There's Richard Nixon saying one of the things that you've heard me say over the years, the reason that we support Israel, I'm saying we in an American diplomatic and a governmental sense, is because of the liberal order. They're a democracy in the Middle East. And because of their experience that happened during the Holocaust, and that factored heavily into the justification for making Palestine the area where they would go at the time they went there. So that's, and that may be coming unraveled now. I think that that is very likely coming unraveled now. And when you hear him say that we don't have a strategic interest, that is part of the reason perhaps for that. I think there's other reasons too, but what should the United States be doing, I suppose, is the greater question. And it is a complicated question if you answer it the way that I answer it. I think the United States should be looking for ways where they can pull back from foreign involvement and put the resources that we have, which are limited, towards our own people and our own problems. We have such a severe problem with what we've let happen at the border. We need to mobilize a force. If we can go send bombs into other countries, why can't we have a force that's capable of deporting the millions of people who are here illegally? If we don't have a border, we don't have a country. And this is fundamental. Israel, if you care about Israel and you think that that alliance is a strategically good thing, you should care about our own border first and foremost, because if we fall because of internal rot and internal cultural, being hollowed out economically and in other ways, then Israel doesn't have any lifeline, right? They're on their own. And my instincts are that Israel has, maybe you're relying on miracles, but Israel has had a lot of those. At least it looks that way, okay? I'm saying from a military perspective, Israel's done some incredible things, whether it's God's providence or it's something else. My gut is that Israel can defend herself, and we should be looking to unchain ourselves from that arrangement. And one of the ways we can do that in a way that is mutually beneficial is by making Israel a trading partner. We don't need to send them all the aid we send them. Let's sell them the weapons that they need to take care of the enemies that are around them. They're not going to use them on us. You could say that they lobby us hard and these kinds of things. Although I was thinking about it this morning. I haven't had a chance to look into it deeply, but I don't know if you saw the mayor of New York right now is, I guess this radical Muslim guy. And, of course I live not far from there. So I'm somewhat aware because I saw advertisements and stuff, but I wasn't keeping close track on it. I thought Cuomo was going to win because those were the polls just a few weeks ago. And Cuomo, so anyways, it was a bunch of, I guess it was young white people that put him over. That was another thing that surprised me. I thought it was third worlders who had come in a coalition, in a sense that had come to New York and had done this. No, those guys were for Cuomo. So this radical Muslim guy who's a Marxist, and by the way, there's connections there. Talk to Trevor Loudon. They're fascinating. He is now going to be the mayor of New York, and he got money from CARE and stuff. So it's like we have lobbying groups, if you want to call them that, because what is CARE? CARE, I mean, it's not, is it on behalf of Iran? Is it on behalf of Saudi Arabia? I haven't looked into it deeply. It's on behalf of the Muslim world, though. And I mean, this is a group, they're basically lobbying, and they're getting powerful figures in our government. And you have Israel they have powerful figures that are have allegiance to them in our government. And this is the problem. It's like, why do we have people in our government that are so concerned about some of these things over there? Well, one of the reasons is there are incentives to be concerned with those things. But I think behind that are deeper moral commitments that Richard Nixon talked about there. And we'll see what happens with the post-liberal left, which is the woke left. They're post-liberal. And then sort of some elements of the post-liberal right, meaning more the, and this is a broad group, so it's very hard to define, but some of the more, anything from the more Nazi enthusiastic portions to just the kind of general people that are very heavily believe in a Jewish conspiracy and see Israel at the center of this. They are, of course, and then you also have even, you know, your libertarian foreign policy guys who are just for those reasons against this strong attachment. Those guys are gaining steam with their foreign policy in some respects. And so we may be looking at a different situation in the future. I don't know. I don't know where this is all going to go. Just because polling says one thing about young people now doesn't mean it's always going to say that either. Sometimes people think they want something, and then you start counting the cost of Iran having a nuke, and you start thinking, maybe I don't want that. So lots of things to balance, lots of things to discuss, but these are complex issues. And so I guess I'd cap it off by saying, yes, my solution is to try to disentangle this, but to have strong economic partnerships where we can. And I know even that I'm kind of squirrely about, but I don't know that you can go back to completely to the world before mass travel and interballistic missiles and some of the things that we have now. We have to look at, be inspired by the principles of the past, and Washington's principles are certainly strong. And I would consider myself someone who doesn't want foreign entangling alliances, but we have to be America first about it. We can't entangle ourselves. That's the key. We can't entangle ourselves in these things. If these things work to our advantage as a country, then good. But if not, that we need to pull back. And so in the Middle East, I would be in favor of pulling back. We just give Israel money and then yank their chain when they're about to do something. And that even happened this time, right? They were about to send more bombs in there. And Trump, by the way, proved to everyone he's not a shill for Israel, because he told them where it was at and they stopped. So this whole idea that Israel's controlled by Trump, oh my goodness, guys, like, it's more complicated than that. Try to think clearly on these things. Trump has his own agenda, and he wants to be friendly with Israel, but he's going to put them in their place if they get out of line. But wouldn't it be better if we could get to an arrangement where we can let Israel do what Israel needs to do with their enemies? Maybe we can sell them weapons, maybe to some extent, I don't know, intelligence sharing, but we're not going to get directly involved, and we're going to try to keep ourselves out. Those are my instincts. I could probably do some more thinking about it to come up with specific policies, but those are my druthers. And I think Trump shares a similar instinct, except for the fact that he does just seem to want to be the deal maker in these things. And that does make him have this more imperialistic posture sometimes. You know, he wants to be America first, but he also wants to put his foot into these situations and talk like, you know, he can work them like a boardroom. So, all right, I will take questions now, and then we'll end the podcast. And hopefully that was enlightening and helpful for you. And hopefully that was, if you like this podcast, if this was helpful, and I'm hoping for some of you this was beyond and more than many of the podcasts you've listened to on this subject. I hope you've learned more from this than most of the podcasts where I just see podcasts out there where people are just sitting around sharing their opinions, and their opinions are like 10 years old, or if not 10 months old sometimes on this. I hope this was helpful because you get the long view, and that's, and my goal is to give you the information so you can make a correct, informed decision. And some things are gray. They're not all black and white. I don't want you just going and jumping into an ideology because it sounds good on paper and it sells you a utopian scheme of some kind. That's not the real world. You got to deal in the real world, guys. That's my goal. So, all right, let's get to some questions here. Jesse Hughes says, I wish I had a class with Professor Ritchie while all this was going on. You know, I had him on. I thought about having him on again. Maybe I will, to talk about all this. He's a military history guy and he's really good on these topics. If the ethnic Jews today are different from ethnic Jews of yesterday, how come that tiny population is still so statistically significant in our current world? No other nation approaches it. I hear you. I hear you on that. And having traditions that go back and having this strong in-group preference that does allow some proselytes to come in, but there's still a strong genetic connection. There's still strong traditional connections, and there's still even a strong religious connection that goes back. Even if you want to say, well, the temple was destroyed, so now it's a different kind of Judaism or something like that. Okay. You know, it's out Talmudic. That's what they'll say. It's Talmudic Judaism. And it's very different, you know, okay. But it's an extension of what the Pharisees had without a temple, essentially. And there were times in Jewish history, they didn't have a temple. So this is something that, you know, they still have kept many of the same festivals, the same practices. You have to say that today's Judaism does trace back. You at least have to say that, right? Obviously, the church being the Israel of God and the spiritual Israel. Do with that what you will. Let's see. The book of Revelation prophesied the rise of Islam in Revelation 9, 5th, and 6th trumpets. You know, I'm not convinced of that, but I understand people who go down that line. I actually was one of the few, I was the only one that I know of. I challenged John MacArthur in 2011. I was at a chapel at the Master Seminary. I got up and I said, hey, because John MacArthur was on that kick. I said, show me this from scripture. And it's really just looking at parallels of Islamic eschatology and then probably Sunni eschatology. And then looking at I don't know if it's Sunni or Shiite. I'm not sure. MacArthur read a book on it and he was like, it's a flipped eschatology, therefore. And I was like, I'm careful of that, man. Is it the Catholic Church in a premillennial scheme? Is it the Muslims? Is it this or that? I'm careful. I don't want to go beyond what scripture says, but it's fun to speculate about those things. And I get it. Pray for the Persian people. Yes. Do pray for them. Keep up the great work, John. Thanks, Eugene. Appreciate that. Why isn't Jimmy Carter turning his back on the Shah for Khomeini in 1979 ever? I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry, Martha. Carter, one of the worst presidents ever, and his Christianity was wishy-washy too. Yeah, I'm gonna admit something that will get me in trouble with everyone here, but I'm just gonna admit it. And I know, yeah, Tom Rush is like in my ear now saying, John, don't do this, because I know he doesn't like Jimmy Carter. There is this little soft spot I have for him, I'm gonna admit. And I'm not saying I like his foreign policy. I don't know what it is. He had some like Southern agrarian instincts that just, I don't think he was like he wasn't like a dirty politician, I guess. And that's maybe as far as my admiration goes, but there's, on a personal level, I think I would have loved to hang out with him. Actually, when he passed, I started to get fascinated a little bit with his family and I was just watching the funeral and I was like, go to old videos of his brother. They're super interesting. But anyway, like he actually set the stage for some deregulation, especially in the travel agencies. And so not everything he did was bad. But of course, yeah, I mean, he, on the foreign policy especially, he's remembered very poorly. And I understand why. And then they became best pals with all these dictators. And it's like, that was really bad. But you wonder whether or not the Reagan campaign team was undercutting him with Iran. I understand. I love Ronald Reagan. I probably shouldn't admit this. I'm admitting all my weaknesses, but that Reagan movie, I actually cried at the end. He's riding his horse on the Reagan ranch and it's right. I mean, I'm a Californian by birth and I'm a Californian by heart still. And I've realized that over time, like being even in New York and raised primarily in New York and then living in North Carolina and Virginia and having a strong connection to Mississippi and all these things, like I still have so many California instincts and I feel at home with people from there. It's very odd perhaps. But I don't know. I, and it makes me love Reagan. I'm proud of Reagan, but, He might have been undercutting Carter. I'm just saying. If that Tucker Cruz argument could have been easily cleared up, we have to look at the morality of everything. God isn't saying to just blindly support everything, anything the Jews and their government does. And you got to understand, it's not just the Jews and their government. You got to make a separation between the Jews, whatever that is, right? I mean, that's a broad group. And then Israel. The state of Israel has, like I said, competing factions in it. It also has non-Jews in it. There's Muslims who are Israeli citizens, right? It's a secular government, and you need to understand that. And so supporting the modern state isn't even the same as supporting ethnic Jews. And so anyway, glad to hear about your future podcast on different 10 times perspective. Pre-trib has infested many churches. You may not like all my podcasts then. You know, I haven't gotten into pre, mid, and post-trib, right? I'm more interested in the broad perspective of like covenantal, dispensational. So far I've only done, and I'll do tomorrow post-mill, but I've already done, weeks ago I did dispensationalism, and then today I did, and that was with Peter Gaiman at Shepherd's Theological Seminary. Today I did with Dr. Russell Fuller, amillennialism, and then tomorrow with Pastor Joseph Spurgeon, I'm doing post-millennialism, which I confess I probably know the least about, even though I know about all of them. They're very complicated. It's very complicated. So they might have, let's see here. What other questions do we have? Countries are lining up to give nukes to Iran. Iran doesn't need to make nukes. They will have nukes whether or not anyone doesn't like. Yeah, I've seen that Russia supposedly made an offer. There's a risk to doing that, though. You make that offer and then you're becoming at war with the United States. I think a lot of that is bluster, to be honest with you. China got into the geopolitical game way too late to get one over on the U.S. I think that's part of why Trump did what he did. It was like now or never. We got the skies are clear. Let's do it. Let's see. During the Cold War, Israel was a bulwark against the Soviets. Yes, that Javier makes such a good point here. You got to understand that connection we had with Israel was partially formed in Cold War era arrangements. And people, you know, if you don't understand what the Cold War was like and how scary that was for people, the fear of Iran getting a nuke isn't going to make sense to you. Have you looked into the USS Liberty? Yes, it was years ago. I think I did a paper on it actually, but that was like 2008 or seven. I did not take, at the time I did it, and I would have to revisit the issue, okay? At the time I did it, though, I remember the conclusion I had after looking at all the evidence, because there's two primary stories, right? One is that this was a mistake, this was an accident. The other is that Israel just shot one of our boats in order to somehow pull us into war and that kind of thing. And that's the prevailing, I would say that's the prevailing view now online is, I remember thinking that the first view made more sense, but that was a long time ago. I looked into it, and I'm probably a better historian on handling sources now, so maybe I'll revisit it. But to me, you know, speaking of the Navy, something I did not mention, I don't know if you know this. Let me see if I can pull a Joe Rogan here in real time and look it up for you. One of the largest naval battles was between the United States and Iran. And let's see if I can pull it up. It's Operation Praying Mantis. I should have mentioned this. Why didn't I? I'll add it to the notes if you're a patron so you can see it. And is it Operation Praying Mantis? Is that one of, let's see. I'm seeing if I can. Okay, so April 1988 attack by the United States on Iranian naval targets in the Persian Gulf. So this was an oil war. I should have mentioned this, honestly, and my bad for not doing it. Let's see if I can bring this up for all of you to see. Okay, here it is. So we actually, in 1988, we attacked Iran in the Persian Gulf in retaliation for the mining of U.S. warship, a U.S. warship 4 days earlier. And this is a fascinating story too. You could check, that's the Wikipedia page, but you could check out that whole story. And we decimated half the Iranian Navy. So if you want to know why there's bad blood between the United States and Iran, it's not just Israel. We kind of decimated half their Navy in 1988. So there you go. Kim Murphy says, yesterday was the Democrat primary won by Democrat socialists. We talked about that. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm just realizing the time. I got to go. I am going to be late if I don't get off the podcast now. I'm leading Bible study tonight on the Book of James. You can pray for me. God bless. More coming. Bye now.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.